from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't very often talk about my own life on this broadcast. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a life the way I talk. I will break that rule today, moments from now. That's if that's not an incentive for you to stay tuned. No, it's just stuff has been in the news, and so I have to clear it up and expand on it. But first, it's been a week that is hard to understand or has some hard-to-understand elements in it. Take this, for example. I thought public broadcasting, let's say your PBS television, had the mission of bringing public service-oriented programming to the widest possible audience. You know, over-the-air broadcasting. So that people, whatever their income level, could avail themselves of high-quality public service broadcasting. That's why we give. Assuming that we... Dateline New York. PBS said Thursday it had received a grant to plan a new cable network for public affairs programming. That's right. Now you have to have cable or satellite to see the... It hopes to start in early 2005. Won't you give? Tentatively called PBS Public Square. That's right, because PBS isn't square enough already. They have to. It will mostly air reruns of NewsHour. Okay, I don't feel cheated now. I don't have to pay my cable bill. Reruns of NewsHour, Now with Bill Moyers, and talk shows with Charlie Rose and Tavis Smiley. So won't you please pay your cable bill? A $200,000 grant from a journalism-oriented foundation has set the plan in motion. But PBS will probably need more than $25 million to get the whole thing going. So won't you give? PBS President Pat Mitchell says she envisions it as providing programming that enlightens and engages and doesn't raise the blood pressure. Or the wakefulness level. She didn't say that. It's one area where we can clearly claim to be executing and delivering on our mission to inform and engage citizens, she said. As long as they have cable. This is a space where we can really deliver where nobody else is going to, she said, ending her sentence. Preposition with. The public affairs schedule on PBS won't be affected by PBS Public Square. Replaying the shows several times on a cable channel allows PBS a greater return on the investment of producing them. So, That's the mission, ladies and gentlemen. I can't say I understand it, but I support it nonetheless, because understanding is really only, it's the least of the responsibilities you have when you give. And at the top of the broadcast also, a couple of items. One, definitely within the bubble, because he wrote a book. And if you write a book, you definitely get inside the bubble. Discussing the case for Iraq in an interview with Times White House correspondent, former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, who has a book coming out and is on 60 Minutes this week, he sat on the National Security Council, did Paul O'Neill. He says the focus was on Saddam Hussein from the earliest days of the administration. In the 23 months I was there, he says, this is a quote, I never saw anything that I would characterize as evidence of weapons of mass destruction. There were allegations and assertions by people, but I've been around a hell of a long time, and I know the difference between evidence and assertions and illusions or allusions and conclusions that one could draw from a set of assumptions. To me, there's a difference between real evidence and everything else. And I never saw anything in the intelligence that I would characterize as real evidence. Unquote Paul O'Neill. Also inside the bubble this week from the Washington Post, Iraq flouted a legal duty to report the designs it had for weapons of mass destruction. The weapons they depicted, however, did not exist. In March, they fit in the pocket of an engineering PhD, Moder Sadek Sabah Tamimi. He designed and built a new short-range missile during Iraq's four-year hiatus from United Nations arms inspections. Those were the missiles that were crushed when the UN inspectors returned and found that the range was a little bit long. Anyway, the nine-month record of arms inspectors since the fall of Baghdad includes discoveries of other concealed arms research, most of it less advanced than his. Iraq's former government engaged in abundant deception about its ambitions and, in some cases, early steps to prepare for development or production. Interviews among Iraqi weaponeers and investigators from U.S. and British governments turned up unreported records, facilities, or materials that could have been used in unlawful weapons. But in public statements and unauthorized interviews, investigators said they have discovered no work on former germ warfare agents. Even germs have agents now, such as anthrax, and no work on a new designer pathogen combining pox and snake venom that led U.S. scientists on a highly classified hunt for several months. The investigators assessed that Iraq did not resume production of its most lethal nerve agent, VX, or learn to make it last longer. And they found the former nuclear weapons program, described as a grave and gathering danger by President Bush and a mortal threat by Vice President Cheney, in the same shattered state left by UN inspectors in the 1990s. A non-conventional arms establishment far less capable than U.S. analysts judged before the war. Leading figures in Iraqi science and industry described factories and institutes that were thoroughly beaten down by 12 years of conflict, arms embargo, and strangling economic sanctions. The remnants of Iraq's unconventional weapons infrastructure were riven by internal strife, bled by schemes for personal gain, and handicapped by deceit up and down the lines of command. Hey, sounds like they were privatized. The broad picture emerging from the investigation to date suggests that whatever its desire, Iraq did not possess the wherewithal to build a forbidden armory on anything like the scale it had before the Persian Gulf War. So it was on paper, and we think of it.
Yeah.
You know, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to float a theory for you. We wanted to send a message to the, quote, bad guys of the world. We'll come after you. So we picked a guy who'd already been demonized 12 years down the line. So the spade work was done, and the weakest of the bunch. Look how much it's costing us to take the weakest guy out. So why would we go after anybody stronger? To send a message, basically. It's a $200 billion message. Next time, use Western Union. Hello, welcome to the show.
On my way up, you reach out and grab my hand, and my eyes shake, leaving this wonderland. So many dreams sacrificed, so many hopes dead inside. Yeah, 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 rings awake me, stinging my head with light. And the day grows bigger than I can climb. So much has passed to regret. So much I tried to forget. I'm only asking to get myself. try to remember what in my mind aches, thinking it's all too much, so many fools cannot see. So many fools like me. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Brings awake me, filling my heart with weight, and it makes it easy to take the bait. So many cells to break, so many roads to take. I'm only asking to get myself.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. The year is so young, and already we have two great cliches, media cliches, that have embedded themselves into our consciousness. This is the first, of course, is embedding. Starting last year when the Pentagon had their program for embedding journalists into troop units in the, you know, we had a war in Iraq. Do you remember that? Now MSNBC has embedded reporters in the presidential campaigns of the Democratic candidates for the nomination. They're embeds. And that doesn't mean they're in bed with the candidate. That just means they're embedded with them. Excuse me. No, you're excused. And the other major cliche already deeply embedded is gaffe. Gaffe is, well, supposedly when you shoot your mouth off, you know who that's being applied to, along with the other cliche about him. He's angry. But my favorite example of the gaffe in action, or in gaffshin, is this week the clips from an old Canadian talk. Now, when you're chief investigative reporter, and this is NBC News, her scoop for the week is digging up 100 hours of old Canadian talk shows. Geez, you got to increase the investigative budget, don't you think? I mean, next thing she's going to do is find the mad cow. We found it. It's Canadian, too. They're contributing so much to our culture now these days. But the 100 hours of an old Canadian talk show on which Howard Dean was a panelist had a little too much spare time as governor of Vermont, and it was a short flight. And he says, apropos of the caucus system in use in a few states, including most notably Iowa, although I don't believe in the clip he singled out Iowa, but he's being quoted as if he did. He said it's the caucus system caters to the extremes, the extreme members of both parties. It doesn't cater to the centrist elements that decide an election. I know, sounds like something that's come out of the mouth of every pundit for the last 48,000 years. Not only that, if you look at the tape, it's been shown about 4 million times this weekend, ladies and gentlemen. The pundits are, I guess, journalists, Canadians, maybe Americans, who knows. The guys sitting on either side of Dean on the panel are nodding while he says this. Of course, they're not running for president, so it's not a gaffe for them to nod. And also, it was a gaffe last week for him to say Saddam Hussein should have or Osama bin Laden should have a fair trial. That was a gaffe. He was guilty of shooting off his mouth because he didn't shoot off his mouth like the other candidates and said, fry him. So you're guilty of shooting off your mouth if you don't shoot off your mouth enough. It's a good year in the making, ladies and gentlemen. And already we have several tales of airport security. No gaffes here. Just the straight stuff. There almost was a gaffe, but you'll never know. Here we go. Dear Harry, my new husband, or my current husband, as I often refer to him, and I purchased airline tickets a few weeks after we got married for a flight from L.A. to San Antonio, Texas for Christmas. By the time the holidays rolled around, this surname change that takes several weeks to process through the Social Security Department, the DMV, etc., had finally come through. So one of our airline tickets had my maiden name. I guess it's okay for me to... I won't. While my ID, my driver's license, had my married name. I couldn't imagine that even the most bureaucratic of small minds would be thrown by this, since all I had done was add an additional surname to the name already shown on my ticket. She took the maiden name and just added a married name to it. How amusingly naive of me. As soon as I flashed my new ID, I was told that I had been profiled. And my husband and I were delayed with various intrusive searches throughout our trip. During the first search, I sort of chuckled and explained, as if embarrassed, that I'd been profiled because of my recent name change. A guard was quick to correct me with an authoritative, "There are many reasons, ma'am, that you may have been selected for profiling." As he suspiciously eyed my copy of Barry Glassner's The Culture of Fear, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Things. Drew writes, "Dear LeShow, my girlfriend and I were flying out of JFK this Christmas. We separated her computer from her bags as required before going through the metal detector. My girlfriend was selected to be searched more thoroughly after going through. After the inspector finished searching her bag, I went to put the computer back inside. The guard became alerted and said, 'Where'd that come from?' I told her it was separated at the front of the scanner, as it's supposed to be. She then scrunched up her face and told me, 'Oh, we don't talk to them over there,' referring to the inspectors 10 feet away on the other side of the metal detector. In the end, we got to Florida and discovered my girlfriend had accidentally brought her razor and scissors in her carry-on." Joey writes, "Dear Harry, I was dropping off family members at Newark Airport on January 2nd. I pulled my car up to the curb in front of the departure terminal and began to unload the luggage. As I did, I noticed, leaning against a nearby pole and facing my car, a TSA agent working some sort of palm-sized device. Being that we were at a heightened state of alert, I assumed she was typing my license plate number into a device similar to those used by the traffic and parking enforcement police. Uncomfortable that the TSA was now checking license plates, or so I thought, I quickly said goodbyes to my family and members and started back for my car. On the way, I looked at what the agent was doing. To my surprise, she wasn't checking my license plate. She was playing a Game Boy. And finally, Carrie, a PhD, if you please, writes, "Dear Mr. Shearer," well, yeah, doesn't call me Dear Harry because he's a PhD. "My family and I and about 5,000 other people had an unpleasant encounter with Homeland Security on January 6th. We arrived at Chicago's O'Hare Airport from London about 7 p.m. to find unusually long lines of people waiting to clear customs and immigration. We knew it was a bad sign when people ahead of us were sitting on the ground, some of them reading, others playing cards. Apparently, the customs agent's computer system had crashed. Rumor soon spread that the system for the entire country was down. I imagined lines of this sort at every international arrivals terminal in the United States. We were delayed about 45 minutes before a cheer went up from the front of the masses indicating the computers were working again. Is there no backup system in place in case of computer failure? Is Plan B just to keep everyone waiting indefinitely? Did this have anything to do with the implementation of US Visit, the biometric screening program for foreign visitors that started this year? Were people able to leave the US during this time, or are the systems not linked? Am I getting paranoid? You betcha. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. The United States should bring U.S. inspectors into the probe of Iraq's weapons programs to accurately understand how effectively the U.N. inspectors were working, says the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. They like the U.N., so they should say that. The Bush administration has quietly withdrawn from Iraq a 400-member military team whose job was to scour the country for military equipment. It was described by some military officials as a sign the administration might have lowered its sights and no longer expects to uncover the caches of chemical and biological weapons originally sought. A separate military team that specializes in disposing of chemical and biological weapons remains part of the Iraq Survey Group, searching Iraq for more than 7 months at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars, but that team is still waiting for something to dispose of, a survey group member said. All right, that's enough of that. That's so much enough of that, ladies and gentlemen, that It is now time for the Apologies of the Week.
We're so sorry.
Somebody told me Aaron Brown is doing this on CNN now. Hi, Aaron. You're welcome. A woman who told police she bought and lost a lottery ticket worth $162 million all but admitted Thursday that she made it up, saying tearfully, "I wanted to win so bad for my kids and my family, I apologize." Alicia Battle said she's dropping her lawsuit over the Mega Millions jackpot that was awarded Tuesday to somebody else. She apologized to her husband, Jemison, and her attorney. "I'm not a bad person, I'm really not," she said. "Everyone has a past." Days after the December 30th drawing, Battle filed a police report saying she had lost the winning ticket, possibly when she dropped her purse. Police said she will probably be charged with filing a false police report. Much like Michael Jackson complaining about the... That won't be a police thing. Channel 9 Australia has apologized to its viewers offended by the derogatory use of the word Aboriginal during a drama imported from the United States this week. The latest episode of Judging Amy, shown this past week, used the word during a discussion about young men's parties. When men get together to celebrate being men, something happens. They become Aboriginal. They start to leak brain cells, said lead character Amy. She was expressing her disgust at a family member's plans to attend a party at which scantily clad women would be the bawdy entertainment. Vic Reddy, down in Australia, said he was watching with his girlfriend when he heard the word. "We looked at each other and I said, did that just happen? Then the shock of it sank in," he said. "Even though I'm not from that background, I'm still Australian. I didn't like it at all." He said the program should have been edited for its Australian audience. A Channel 9 spokesman said two complaints were made. "We weren't aware that this episode contained the line, and so it wasn't discussed before transmission. We don't believe the writers of this American family series were referring to Australians. We apologize to anyone who was offended by it." Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton apologized for joking that Mahatma Gandhi used to run a gas station in St. Louis, saying that it was a lame attempt at humor. Telling you, amateurs, don't try this at home or on the campaign trail. The New York Democrat made the remark at a fundraiser last week during an event for Senate candidate Nancy Farmer. Clinton introduced a quote from Gandhi by saying he ran a gas station down in St. Louis. After laughter from many in the crowd of at least 200 subsided, the former First Lady continued, "No, Mahatma Gandhi was a great leader of the 20th century." Director of a U.S. center devoted to Gandhi's teaching said the remarks amounted to stereotyping and were insensitive. Clinton suggested to the AP that she never meant to fuel the stereotype, often used as a comedic punchline, that certain ethnic groups are on America's gas stations. "I have admired the work and life of Mahatma Gandhi, have spoken publicly about that many times. I truly regret it if a lame attempt at humor suggested otherwise." And the stereotype would be convenience stores, wouldn't it? The governor of Connecticut saying I have lived my own personal nightmare. Governor John G. Rowland admitted that he lied to the residents of the state, apologized, and pleaded to keep his job in the face of mounting ethical scandals. "I was wrong when I accepted gifts given by state employees and from friends who do business with the state," he said in a 6-minute speech televised live across the state. "But worse, I was wrong in failing to truthfully address those issues. I lied, and there are no excuses." And Newsweek's Los Angeles bureau chief, David Jefferson, went through the interviews, negotiated over salary and start date, and accepted a high-level job of associate editor of the Los Angeles Times editorial pages. It put him number 2 to a woman who once censored me when I wrote a piece for them. Oh, but never mind that. On Monday this week, he reported for work on the second floor. On Tuesday, he quit and returned to his old job at Newsweek. He apologized but felt he'd made a mistake taking the job. His quantum boss quipped, "Britney's marriage lasted longer." But I can understand why somebody might quit that job almost immediately upon taking it, as I just alluded to. There's a few more, even though the music has run out. Big Apology Week, ladies and gentlemen. A U.S. soft drinks manufacturer has issued an apology to his customers after failing to keep up with demand for its new product, Turkey and Gravy Soda. Seattle-based Jones Soda Company says the response to the festive flavor has been incredible. A spokesman said, "We apologize if you were not able to get your hands on the Turkey and Gravy Jones Soda." And now, Jury selection for the murder trial of Robert Blake began a full month before the publicly announced date, and while news organizations were still being advised by the Superior Court Information Office that selection would start February 9th. This ran in the Associated Press file on Thursday of this week. "It was not a deliberate attempt to deceive anyone, particularly the media," said the spokesman for the Los Angeles County Superior Court. "There was some confusion, for which we apologize." Ladies and gentlemen, I knew they were starting the Robert Blake jury selection process 4 days earlier than that. You may have read about this. There's a new law in California. You can't fool around with summonses for jury duty anymore. You have to show up. Eventually, you have to show up. Now, talk about reasons for depressing voter turnout. I can think of no better one. Don't you get off the jury duty thing if you get off the voter list? Anyway, so I showed up 8 o'clock, and within about an hour, well, first of all, they give you a questionnaire to fill out, which is basically kind of a, how did you find out about this courthouse questionnaire? You know, they want to know your background, and it's almost like the questionnaires you fill out, you know, when you've bought a product, and they want to know, we want to know more about you so we can bother you better. They give us an hour to do that, and then they show us, it's 200 of us in the jury assembly room in Van Nuys, California. Beautiful Van Nuys, California. Then they show us about 9 o'clock, they show us a video which tells us how important this work is that we're going to do, how important a role we play in the democratic process, what an important thing we're doing. But from the minute we come in there to the minute we leave, we're being treated like cattle being herded toward the automatic deboning machine. So you're trying to figure out, all right, which is the message that they really mean? California has also changed its law so that you do not get paid for the first day you show up for jury duty. Because it's the law. Hey, we can do it. So, you know, I'm $15. I figure Arnold Schwarzenegger now owes me $15. That's the way I figure it. So we sit around for another couple hours. Now, everybody, talk about when you think, when the guy in the airport thought things were going bad because everybody was sitting around playing cards on the floor. Everybody tells you, bring a book. Bring a long book. I brought several periodicals and an iPod. So, you know, everybody's deep in their own world of, I'm not here. If I really, really focus on not being here, maybe they won't think I'm here and they'll let me go. About 3 hours in, a woman judge appears, a woman judge I later learn is Judge Shemp. Quiet you. It's S-C-H-E-M-P-P. Shemp. I know. Judge Larry and Judge Moe couldn't make it. Judge Shemp shows up and says, we have a very interesting case that we're looking for a jury for today. It's the word she used. It's the Robert Blake murder trial. Now, I'm turned around. I don't see Judge Shemp. I just hear her because I'm into my magazine and my newspaper and my iPod. So I don't know until I'm told later that standing with Judge Shemp in the jury assembly room looking us over, excuse me, is Robert Blake. I missed it. He saw my back. I hope he liked my back. She says, the case is going to take 4 to 5 months. Can I see the hands of the people who will be available for that? 6 people raise their hands out of a room of 200. Okay, well, the rest of you are going to have to fill out hardship forms. We have to justify why we can't take 5 months out of our lives to do the Robert Blake case. So the rest, now, back to that original questionnaire, first one we filled out, after 2.5 hours, we're told, I hope you all filled it out in black pen or number 2 pencil, because that's the only acceptable. Oh, and the whole room groans. So now we have to line up to get new forms to fill them out again, because they didn't tell us that before we filled them out. We had an hour to fill them out. They had an hour to tell us that. They didn't. We line up. As we're lining up to get the new forms, another lady comes out and says, blue pen's fine. And I'm thinking, I know this is my first day here, But haven't you guys done this before? Anyway, we go across, lunch break. After lunch, we go across the street to the new courthouse, the one that isn't being earthquake fixed. And it's there that I discover that the name I heard of, and I thought, that can't be her, indeed was Christina Applegate. She said, I heard your name, and I thought, that can't be him. We both know the same thing. Neither of us is going to serve on the Robert Blake jury. No lawyer in his right mind is going to let even a demi-celebrity like me be on that jury. So we're playing a game. And the game is, you know, let's treat the celebs just as badly as we're treating everybody else. So 4:15, 4 o'clock, she goes in to see Judge Shemp. And she comes out distraught. She's being held over. Now, usually in show business, that's a good thing. Not this time. And now I'm scared. And, you know, I do well when I'm scared. I do well in conditions of fear. Fear and flame. And so I go in. And now CNN reports that I told Judge Shemp I'm needed for the new Spinal Tap movie. Ladies and gentlemen, that's pathetic. A, there's not going to be a new Spinal Tap movie. B, if I told you what there is going to be, you'd really lose your last meal. No, I told the judge I work on The Simpsons, and she said, well, what'll they do if you don't show up? I said, they'll probably sue me for a breach of contract. And I guess she knows the people at Fox because she said, you're excused. So that was my 8.5-hour day. And as I'm driving home, I'm listening on the news to them talking about jury selection in the Martha Stewart case. And they're interviewing jury consultants. And all I can think is, you know, these people make millions of dollars off the jury system. Why don't we just throw a 10% tax on the income of jury consultants to pay the jurors who are the system more than $15 a day and maybe even pay them for the first day? I wish good luck to everybody there. I'll miss you, Van Nuys.
Love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you. If you should ever leave me, well, life would still go on, believe me. The world could show nothing to me. So what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
What I mean. live on tape. Larry King, live. We're on tape tonight because while you're watching this show, I'm emceeing the Cirrhosis Foundation's Chopped Liver Ball. Tomorrow night, a full hour with the woman who sold Lacey Peterson her maternity wardrobe. Tonight, an important discussion. We've already called it that to save you the trouble of deciding about religion and politics and religion. Joining us from Virginia Beach, Virginia, a town so nice they almost named it twice, the host and the owner of the 700 Club, former presidential candidate Pat Robertson. And from the studio of our Des Moines affiliate, KRNL-TV, Colonel 7, is current Democratic presidential candidate and former governor of Vermont, Howard Dean. Welcome to you both. Reverend Robertson, you said last week that God told you that President Bush was going to win this year's election big time. Do you really talk to God about what's happening in American politics?
Well, Larry, when you're in public life and you have a personal relationship with Jesus, you talk to him about all sorts of things. The future of the country, the quality of the crews at remote studios, you name it.
You wouldn't bet on what he tells you, would you?
Well, Larry, I'm not a betting man. I think that's one reason I'm privy to this kind of information.
So you don't have to hear, please hold. He's on the other line with Larry Flint.
That's right.
Is God telling you what he thinks is going to happen or what he's going to make happen? You know what I mean?
I do. Yeah. And Larry, I think the answer, simply put, is that God is the 800-pound gorilla in our universe. Yeah. You know, what is he telling me? Whatever he wants. That's why we praise him.
Yeah, we praise him. We love him. Governor Dean, you got into this whole religion thing when you told a reporter that your favorite book of the New Testament was Job.
Yeah.
Now even a delicatessen Jew like me knows that Job was in the Old Testament. Otherwise, he's like goonish to me. Mm-hmm. But was that just one of your gaffes?
Larry, first of all, religion has been a very personal thing in my life. Yeah. I haven't talked about it. But now that it's a political necessity to expose that side of myself to public view, that was just my best estimate at the moment. I corrected that within the hour. Job, of course, is Old Testament. Yeah. I was asked my favorite book in the New Testament. When you think about it, it's kind of a trick question because you naturally start thinking about the Bible as a whole.
Yeah.
What was in my mind at that moment was the book of John. Job was what came out. I meant my book of John is my favorite book of the Old Testament. Of the New Testament, unless there's a book of Joan that I...
Don't look at me.
Larry, if what the governor is asking is, was there women's lib in the writing of the New Testament, the answer is no.
I was choosing John, obviously, but I was identifying more with Job only in the context of a private identification.
Pat Robertson, does religion influence...
Job was a just man, a moral man, and God chose to test him by stripping him bare.
Yeah, well, you're still wearing nice suits.
Larry, I think when the founding fathers prohibited Congress from restricting the free exercise of Christianity, and to be fair, some other faiths. Yeah. They wanted the people to know enough about the Bible that they wouldn't be bedazzled by the words of a born-again secularist.
Friday night, Mark Garagus is here with the videos Michael Jackson never wanted you to see until he offered them exclusively to us. Howard Dean, do you want God out of the public square?
Larry, I think it's in the one of my favorite books of the Bible, the Book of Jim. By the way, I identify with Jim even more than Job because, in a way, there's a self-pitying aspect to Job, which I just happen to think doesn't play well here in Iowa.
Yeah.
Anyway, the point is, render unto Caesar.
Yeah.
That's in there for sure.
Larry, I'm not going to sit here and get into a scripture-quoting contest with the governor. Let me just use the God-given facilities of your broadcast to tell Governor Dean that the Lord told me not 72 hours ago that if he goes up against President Bush, he'll win no more than 3 states.
Yeah. Did he name them?
Well, again, Larry, let me just remind you here. I was talking to the Lord of Hosts, not Michael Barone.
A distinguished political analyst for U.S. News.
Larry, if I may, and I know my handlers are waving frantically for me not to say this, but I just have to say that in the opinion of this former governor, the good Lord does not have pollsters. I'm pretty sure of that.
Pat Robertson, in our closing moments in this segment, do you think God cares who's the president of the United States?
Larry, God cares who wins the Alabama-Auburn football game, so he's going to kind of care about whom he puts in charge of the entire free world.
Good point. Governor Dean, in our really closing moments, you said your religious faith inspired you to sign the civil union law for gay couples in Vermont.
That's right, Larry, and I'm very proud.
But the question that my intern wants me to ask is, what other actions you took while you were governor
were religiously inspired?
Well, again, I never like to talk about it. I was raised in the Northeast culture where we kept that kind of thing and how much money we made. Pretty much of a private affair.
Yeah,
but I think now that I've had some time to reflect on it, I think that giving tax incentives to businesses that wanted to relocate to Vermont, that may have had a divine spark. After all, if God created entrepreneurs, he can't have not wanted them to be in Vermont as well as everywhere else.
Yeah.
Now, that's just a logical surmise. I mean, unlike Reverend Robertson here, I can't verify that firsthand.
Well, if you'd like me to ask next time when I'm hooked up.
No, that's fine. I'm fine.
You're fine. He's okay. Reverend Robertson, President Bush said that Christians, Jews, and Muslims pray to the same God. Did he have that about right?
Larry, the logical extension of that quote is that the same Lord that speaks to Pat Robertson whispers in the ear of Osama bin Laden. I just don't happen to think that has the ring of truth to it. I don't want to make the mistake of some of my brethren in fellowship and condemn a whole religion.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you who's been talking to Osama bin Laden, and it's Satan. I know that because God told me.
Doesn't Satan sometimes try to trick people by sounding like the voice of God?
He does, but he doesn't very often trick professional men of the cloth, Larry.
Yeah. Governor Dean, your wife's Jewish.
Yes, she is, although, again, that's been within the zone of privacy.
When you come out to L.A., tell her she's got to go to Nathan Al's, best pastrami on the planet.
I'll tell her, Larry.
Tomorrow night, Princess Diana's butler's dentist from Washington. Good night.
Dear God, hope you got the letter, and I pray you can make it better down here. I don't need a big reduction in the price of beer, but all the people that you made know starving on their feet, 'cause they don't get enough to eat from God. Can't believe in me.
Dear God, sorry to disturb you, but I feel that I should be loud and clear. We all need a big reduction in amount.
This is one they have recorded. It's their latest single, and it's in the charts. Coming to you now live, this is The Seeker.
I've looked on the chairs.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is about the time in administrations where the discipline seems to start loosening up. We have Paul O'Neill in this country leaving, being told to leave the Bush administration and firing back. And in Britain, Tony Blair's chief scientist has launched a withering attack on President George Bush for failing to tackle climate change, which he says is more serious than terrorism. Yes, he does. Sir David King, the government's chief scientific advisor, says in an article in the journal Science that America, the world's greatest polluter, must take the threat of global warming more seriously. In my view, climate change is the most severe problem that we're facing today, he says. The Bush administration was wrong to pull out of Kyoto, the protocol, to limit the emission of greenhouse gases, and wrong to imply the protocol could adversely affect the U.S. economy, Sir David says. As the world's only remaining superpower, the United States is accustomed to leading internationally coordinated action. But the U.S. government is failing to take up the challenge. Results of a major study showed that more than a million species will become extinct. You know, that's happened before. I know it's scary, but just pretend a big comet hit us. Sir Davis said the Bush administration is wrong to dispute the reality of global warming. Sea levels were rising, ice caps were melting, and flooding had become more frequent. Countries such as Britain could not solve the problem of global warming in isolation, particularly when the U.S. was by far the biggest producer of greenhouse gases on the planet. So Tony Blair can't keep all the poodles in line indefinitely, I guess. Walkies! Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America on the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, and around the world via the internet on your computer whenever you want it at two different locations, harryshear.com and kcrw.com. And it would be just like all celebrities getting off the Robert Blake jury if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty. Thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at innerworld.net. The show internet services by Steve Mack. The show playlists usually available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Free Christina Applegate.